Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. We're going to be talking today about gynecologic cancers. These are cancers which affect women and include cancers of the cervix, uterus, and the ovaries. I'm pleased and honored to have two guests today. Miss Debbie Polin is a Vermont resident who was diagnosed 9 years ago with ovarian cancer and has been undergoing intermittent treatment since then. She's going to be talking to us about her journey, about the diagnosis, the treatment she's received, the support she's received and given, and how COVID has affected her treatment over the past year. A bit later in the hour, we're going to be joined from Boston by Dr. Ursula Matalonis, who is the oncologist, who is the chief of gynecologic oncology service at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. So first, let me welcome Miss Polin. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, As I mentioned, it's been quite a journey. 9 years ago, you were diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Can you go back to that time and tell us a little bit about what you were experiencing and how you finally came to have a diagnosis?
Sure. I was diagnosed in the end of December 2012. And it was about 7 months prior to that I was just feeling a little off. And symptoms are pretty common to another source. First of all, I was menopausal. So there's no actual true testing for gynecological cancers, especially ovarian. So it's a matter of starting at one place where we did, by me continually going to the doctors until, we began to take further and further and deeper tests. And there was some basic issues like fatigue, feeling full when I was eating, upset stomach, constipation. And then at the very latter part, before I was diagnosed, my abdomen began to swell. I was 55 years old and beginning to look as though I was pregnant. And then at that point, we took some blood tests and sent them off to the Mayo Clinic and a CT scan, which at that point detected the cancer. And I was stage 4 ovarian cancer.
Can you explain what stage 4 means?
Well, it's stage 4 is terminal cancer. There are 4 stages to cancer, and usually stages 1 and 2, and this is something more for Ursula than me, tend to be curable, whereas stage 3 is recurrent. So in other words, you can go without the cancer. You know, the cancer can be supposedly beat, I guess would be the common word that we all use, and then return, and that can return 1 year later, 3 years later, 5 years later. So once you have this diagnosis, you are seen pretty much on a regular basis, with always the assumption that it could probably come back. And stage 4 is that it is outside of the cancer is outside of the uterus, It has gone to other places, and that usually leads to a terminal diagnosis.
You mentioned a number of symptoms you had, and I think this is important because it's one of the unfortunate reasons why ovarian cancer is often diagnosed fairly late stage, because the symptoms are actually very nonspecific, and they can occur in many other non-malignant reasons. Obviously, the abdomen swelling was very different, but that's a problem, isn't it?
It is. They are working very, very hard. I think getting awareness, is really the number one, commitment that a lot of organizations and oncologists and even patients are pushing out there, because we actually, it's a little bit of a quieter kind of cancer. Nobody really talks about it. It's not as loud and proud and easily defined as breast cancer is. So we definitely just always need to get the word out there. And it's never self-diagnosed. I mean, a lot of women, because they're such kind of basic symptoms, I think it's easy to sort of kind of put it off and attribute it to
particularly, as you mentioned, you were already going through menopause and could have been confused
Correct.
With some of the other symptoms. We should mention,
Correct.
I believe this is September's Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. So
It is.
It should be Awareness Month every month. But and I think the bottom line is, and I think Christiana Monpour from PBS, who was recently diagnosed and is undergoing treatment, made the same statement, that if women feel something is unusual or different, that they should bring it up to their doctor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And don't be afraid to do that.
I mean, you have to be your own advocate. I mean, if you feel the questions aren't answered, you've got to push and push and push. And I helped. I feel I was doing that. And just pushing really hard and just saying, this isn't right. We have to go further. We have to go further.
By the way, I want to let listeners know our phones are open, 802-244-1777. So if you have any questions for either of our guests today or have had some experience with this, please give us a call. So, Ms. Fallon, you were diagnosed, not a diagnosis anyone wants to hear. What was it like for you to sit down? Well, first of all, who gave you the told you about this, and what was your reaction?
I was actually in ER because I had gone and had the CT scan, and it was in the evening, and both nurses came out and just said, Debbie, we're going to take you downstairs to the ER, and a doctor will come in and explain the results to you. And I just knew at that point that something was wrong, because you weren't going home. And then when I got down to the ER, they were really wonderful and had informed me that the crew from the gynecological team will be down in a few minutes. So I pretty much right then and there kind of felt that this is the beginning of something. And we are just going to, I took a big, deep breath and exhaled and just knew we were going to have to go forward with whatever they were going to tell me. And it was going to be one foot in front of the other and one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And really understanding and accepting that this is my cancer. So I wasn't focused on other people's stories and outcomes, and did not run to the computer, because that wasn't a good place to seek answers for me. And we started this journey, and we have an excellent team of surgeons up here at the University Medical Center. So I was really blessed from the get-go.
You're talking about University of Vermont?
I am. Yeah. I was a patient of Dr. Wong's And sometimes you don't have to be in the biggest city in the world to have the best medical care. So we began this journey together, and he really was helpful, and the nurses, in just helping me to understand, because it is so overwhelming. And they kept it in what I say is English. Right. So I always understood everything that was going on.
What an important point you just made a moment ago, though, that this was your cancer, and that, you know, hearing about other people's experiences at times may be helpful, but this is your journey, and that every cancer is different, and every cancer treatment is going to be different. I think that's really
right.
Important.
Exactly. I started, there's sort of a kind of a plan that's pretty laid out that you start with. And, I was in a very, very, very funny place because it was very successful for me to start out with what's called, and these are chemotherapies, Taxol carboplatin. And the treatment before the last one, I went into anaphylactic shock, which is common. And so what that meant for me was no more Taxol and no more carboplatin, which is used in a lot of treatments, because most treatments for these cancers are combination treatments. So that definitely put me in a single treatment category. And so I had gone through about four other different kinds of chemotherapy, and then took a little visit down to Dana-Farber, where they had suggested an oral chemotherapy along with Avastin. And again, I think Dr. Matalonis will get more into details. And Avastin wasn't meant for, particularly for gynecological cancers. It was came about for some others. And now they're finding out, which is really wonderful, that some of the treatments you might do for kidney cancer, you can try on somebody with a gynecological cancer.
Before we go further, I'm going to ask you about surgeries, because historically ovarian cancer there was, and it's now become somewhat, and perhaps Dr. Matalonis can talk about this, somewhat more controversial about what's called debulking surgery, where they go in and remove as much of course, the ovaries and as much as the other tumor tissue as they see.
Right.
Did you have to undergo that?
I did. Because of my age, because I was done with children, my age, and the amount of cancer that I had. It's also very common to start off with a few treatments and to try to get rid of as much cancer as you can prior to surgery rather than just begin with surgery. And that was the protocol that Dr. Wong chose for me and that I agreed to. And that worked for me. I mean, that was very successful. I can't imagine anything else at that moment. But we're already talking, for me, 9 years ago. So a lot has changed since then.
So you did chemotherapy first to reduce the tumor burden as much as possible. Then you underwent some surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And then continued back, once you'd recovered, I assume, continued back into more chemo. Now, you had a great treatment team here at the University of Vermont, and then had you heard about Dr. Matalonis, or what was the connection with Dana-Farber?
I started getting a little involved, carefully involved with reaching out, because I felt, you know, alone. And first of all, we have a beautiful support group here in Burlington called the UVM Teal Women. And I just wanted to learn more, have more involvement, and meet other people, from around the country. So I got involved with NOCC, which is the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition. And I was also very careful to make sure that everything was, you know, a legitimate group. And this is, and it is huge, and it involves, you know, information, support online, conferences, and so those were the kind of things that were helping me along as I went through each step.
Now, I think so, Dr. Matalonis is on the line. Dr. Matalonis, hello.
Oh, great.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're going to talk with you in just a moment, but I want to stay on this track with Ms. Debbie Paulin, who is, of course, your patient and you've known for quite a long time at this point. And Ms. Paulin has had 9 years of treatment now, and it's been quite a journey. So, Ms. Paulin, tell me about you started to talk about the support, and I do know that you have been very active in terms of not only the support you've received, but the support you've given. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, there's family, and I have, we all do. We love our family, and my family became a little knowledge as well. So everything that I talked about, my family could understand, which they all thought was very important, because one of the things that this whole diagnosis made me feel for some reason was lonely, because so much had shifted. I couldn't work anymore. You know, my friends worked, and when you feel you needed people the most, you know, it felt like everybody was a little distant. So we started with family. And then we have wonderful cancer counselors up at the University Hospital. And I have I've had the same counselor now for 9 years. And, she too is a 2-time cancer survivor. So I really, really enjoy speaking with her because she gets it. And again, then we have the UVM Teal Women, and that I miss. That's the one thing COVID, I kind
this
of...
This is a support group?
With. Yes, because I just so enjoyed kind of getting out of the house and going somewhere where there was just us. And we would choose to either laugh, cry, create poetry, sing, dance, and that was kind of my moment that I had with, again, other women that truly, truly understood how I felt.
So then comes COVID last year, and which is obviously was isolating for so many people, but it not only, I imagine, was isolating for you, but it and we hear that it affected cancer, not only cancer diagnosis, but ongoing cancer treatments. Did it affect your treatment in any significant way?
It did. You have your treatment day and treatment time, and it's a pretty regular schedule. So you kind of, you know, get ready to go up there and to have either your mother or your friend, to make the time go by quicker. You have the other patients that or survivors that are up there getting treatment. And again, it's just one of those moments where you kind of all come together. And it was always positive, you know, positive conversations, what somebody did. And you need that. You really need that. It's so much nicer to hear good things when you're living with cancer rather than, you know, the difficulties that you have.
There's also the added complication that most people who are going through cancer treatment are to some degree immunocompromised, which makes obviously exposure to COVID very serious.
Yes. Nobody wanted to visit me. And that kind of, I felt even more isolated, you know, so I did become a winter walker, as I said, because it's something that you had to do, and definitely found some people who were more comfortable being around me
And I happen to know you have a very small furry companion.
Right. Yes. And there is good old Tuck.
That would be a dog, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. And he did. He became my full-time companion. So, but it was hard because there's those moments that you do wake up and you are having a good day and you'd love to be able to at least go to lunch and sit with a friend and just do all these wonderful little things around appointments, around treatments, around maybe having a day where you feel completely fatigued. So sometimes all I felt I had was me, my cancer, well, and Tux. But it was hard.
When people hear about cancer chemotherapy too, there's always the fear of all the side effects. I think we've made progress, and Dr. Matulonis, I'm certain, can talk about this in a few moments. We've made progress in trying to minimize some of those, or eliminate in some cases, some of the side effects. But for you, what were some of the worst side effects of your chemo?
Probably for me, because I was such an active person, was the fatigue. That was harder because I'm used to getting up and doing things and being creative and just kind of laying there in bed and I kind of went through, all right, I've read enough books. Okay, I've done enough crossword puzzles. And so, again, for me, the fatigue was probably the thing that I had the hardest time dealing with. Everything else just kind of came along with it, and I was ready as I could be with as far as, like, if you were dehydrated, I stayed hydrated, you know, ate well, made sure I did eat. So you have a certain sense of energy and nutrition in your body. You know, I was, you know, there's another way. To me, there was the other way of fighting cancer, and that's staying happy and healthy and doing, you know, the best you can, again, to live your life. And, the fatigue was the hardest for me.
Well, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Matulonis, but I hope you'll stay on the line. I think we may have some callers as well. So stay with us, if you will.
Sure.
So I want to, before the break, at least turn to Dr. Ursula Matulonis, who is chief of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. She is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She has grants from the National Cancer Institute focusing on ovarian cancer, and she has led numerous research studies. Dr. Matulonis received her MD from Albany Medical College. She completed her internship and residency in medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, and she trained in medical oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Matulonis, welcome, and thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me. It's great to hear. Debbie, hi, Debbie. How are you? It's great to hear your incredible insights. I've agreed with everything you're saying.
And I think, you know, yeah, in so many ways, Ms. Paulin has encapsulated what you hope people will, how they will approach these cancers, you know, with strength, courage, understanding. She had sounds like a good social network. I'm sure that's not always the case. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think that, and I think, you know, Debbie's comments about COVID and, you know, the impact on how we've how we take care of patients. Of course, I think of, so are we still able to give them treatment and still maintain our clinical research protocols? I mean, that's one issue. But then the other issue is, of course, you know, there's a period, long period where folks could only come in by themselves to be seen. And, you know, that's so hard when only one set of ears can hear, you know, and it's not the same if you're on speakerphone or on a Zoom call. And then hospitalization. I mean, that was really difficult to have somebody go into the hospital and be by themselves and not have visitors come in. I mean, it's a really, really hard time.
We're going to be talking, we're going to have to go to break in about a minute, but we're going to be talking about, I also want to talk about cervical cancers and uterine cancers as well. How do we diagnose these? What are some of the common treatments? And also importantly, are there things we can do to prevent them or reduce the prevalence of these, terrible cancers? So, Dr. Metalonis, cervical cancer, and I know we're going to have to break in just a minute, but cervical cancer is, we are seeing some progress in terms of reducing the number of people, at least in this country. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. We're definitely seeing since the institution of the pap smear, decades ago, the incidence, so the number of new cases per year in the United States of cervical cancer has really steadily dropped. It's really, there's a discrepancy with the number of cases in the United States versus the number of cases elsewhere. So in African countries, in South America, in a lot of, even in Asian and Middle Eastern countries, depending upon healthcare access.
We are going to be, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're going to pick this up as soon as we come back. So stay with us. Dr. Lewis Myers back for the second half of Healthcare Today with Ms. Debbie Pollan and Dr. Ursula Matalonis, who's at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. So, Dr. Matalonis, we were talking before the break about cervical cancer, and you were noting that in the United States, the numbers have gone significantly down. Unfortunately, that's not the case around the world. There are two, and I think it's important for people to know that this is a cancer we can largely prevent. There are two important components to that. One is, and I'd like you to talk about both of them briefly, one is pap smears, and the other is the HPV vaccine.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I was saying before, that the there really has been good news about cervical cancer, and that's not just the U.S., but globally, but that the number of cases, so the incidence, but also how women do from a survival standpoint has been, either stable or improving around the world. And, the number of cases differs per country. In the United States, the number is around 13,000 cases per year. But in a lot of other, like South American countries, Sub-Saharan African countries, the cases are quite high. So the fact that there's good news here, I think, is very promising. Obviously, this is a cancer driven by HPV. Much like
HPV stands for
human papillomavirus.
Okay.
That's right. There are nearly 100 types of human papillomavirus subtypes, but just a handful actually can lead to changes that happen in the cervical mucosa or the cervical cells that can transform a normal cell into a precancerous one and then eventually into a cancerous one. And from the inception of infection to the development of cancer, so cervical cancer, can actually take many years. And that's why the pap smear has been such a successful entity, because changes can be found that are not cancerous but precancerous, dealt with, treated, and then that can lead to that the cervical cancer doesn't develop. And Dr. Myers is correct about the vaccine, and the vaccine has been certainly used in the United States. It's obviously as some people find it controversial. We don't in the medical field, but it does reduce that. It prevents you from developing the HPV infection, and thus will reduce the infection rate, reduce the precancerous changes that can happen in the cervix, and perhaps we're starting to see the benefits of that with a drop in the number of cases.
We should also mention that HPV can, certain types of HPV can occur in young men, While they obviously don't develop cervical cancer, there are other cancers that they can develop. There, the part of the controversy you brought up has to do with some people believe that giving a prepubescent young woman or boy a HPV vaccine somehow increases or gives them permission to have early sexual relations. Is there any evidence of that?
You know, this is not my area of expertise. I'm an oncologist, but I don't think that there is. No, I think that I don't know, but I'm not the expert on this. But okay. I don't think so.
So, let's talk about uterine cancer too. It's not as much in the news. What ages do we tend to see uterine cancer, and what are the symptoms that women should be aware of?
Yeah, you know, in the United States, of all the gynecologic cancers, uterine cancer has the highest new number of cases per year. It's increasing. So there's some troubling trends about uterine cancer. The first is that the number of cases continues to increase roughly a little around 1% per year. Now it's close to just under 70,000 new cases of uterine cancer in the United States per year. Secondly, the survival rates, so how women are doing with the cancer, are actually falling. And it's one of the few cancers that we see that to be the case. You know, most cancers have an improving survival rate. A lot of the gastrointestinal cancers, breast cancer, you know, improvements in overall survival. We're not seeing that with uterine cancer. It's actually dropping. And then another important fact is that there is a disparities issue. So women who are black women have worse outcomes compared to white women. So that's a very disturbing fact that's been shown in multiple trials and multiple studies. So I think a lot of us are working on, you know, coming up with better treatments and also ways to really equalize this disparities issue.
There is some discussion about that some of the increasing numbers in endometrial cancer may be also related to increasing obesity in the United States. Is there any connection there?
Yeah, you know, yes, and I think that's, you know, a few years ago when the cases were just, you know, continuing to increase, and you look at the obesity issue in the United States, but also worldwide, absolutely. You know, there's a clear connection between excess estrogen and uterine cancer, diabetes, kind of this inflammatory syndrome. But what we're seeing also is, so there are different types of uterine cancer, and there are some types that are very estrogen sensitive, and those are types under the microscope called endometrioid. But then there are others that are probably a little bit less estrogen sensitive, called serous, S-E-R-O-U-S, and those cases are actually increasing. So there are things that we can't fully explain why the number of cases is increasing, but I think you're absolutely correct. I think the general trend going upward is related, at least partially, to obesity.
Are there symptoms that women should be aware of? For example, we were taught in medical school that any time a postmenopausal woman has onset of menstrual bleeding, that is of concern and should be checked out. Are there that or other signs or symptoms that people should be aware of?
Yeah, specifically for uterine cancer, I think any abnormal bleeding, because, you know, younger women can develop uterine cancer, especially those who are part of high-risk families like Lynch syndrome, where there's an increased risk of ovarian, uterine, and colorectal cancers. They may notice that they have just increased amounts of bleeding, bleeding between periods. And then just what you mentioned before, somebody who's postmenopausal, kind of just abnormal spotting. But the other, I mean, again, it's always important to think about other symptoms as well. Sometimes there'll be on a pap smear, yes, on a pap smear, which is designed to look at the cervix, sometimes there can be cells that drop from the uterus onto the pap smear, and that can give the gynecologist a signal that there may be something abnormal in the uterus as well.
There is, going back to the pap smear, one more question. There are different recommendations from different national organizations about how often women should be screened with a pap smear and at what age they can sort of decrease their screening, and also if they've had the HPV vaccine. How do people decide how often to get a pap smear?
Yeah, the guidelines, just, you know, speaking with our physician team, who deals with pre-cervical neoplasia, so kind of pre-cervical changes, kind of abnormal pap smears, essentially. The guidelines are constantly changing, and it's an evolution a lot. And I think certainly with or without the HPV vaccine, but I think the bottom line of that answer would be, you got to check in with your gynecologist, because your gynecologist has to know the most recent, up-to-date, recommendations. And I think, but it's also important that even though somebody may have received the vaccine and received the appropriate number of vaccinations, that does not mean that they should not, you know, have pap smears as per the policy. The HPV vaccine, I think, is certainly making an impact. But just like, you know, we're seeing with a lot of vaccines, they're never 100% effective.
Sure. Let's move on in our last 15 minutes or so to an area that you are heavily involved in, which is ovarian cancer. Now, Ms. Paulina talked about the fact that she had a lot of vague symptoms, and it wasn't really until her abdomen started getting distended that she was able to finally get diagnosed. Is that common? Do you see that in ovarian cancers?
Absolutely. It is really the most common way women present, and the symptoms are certainly vague, but to the individual, they're not vague. They know something is wrong, and a lot of times women will go to their primary care physician may say, you know, well, I think you've got irritable bowel or something else, may refer somebody to gastroenterology or an upper or lower endoscopy, which tends not to be able to pick something up because the problem lies outside the intestine, not in the intestine, but symptoms of bloating, sometimes urinary complaints, occasionally even vaginal spotting, if the cancer is actually emanating from the fallopian tube, difficulty with digestion. And usually, you know, folks are very sharp about their symptoms. So something is up. It really behooves all of us collectively in the medical profession to pay attention to all of those symptoms, because somebody comes in, they're making a big effort to come into your office, and usually there's something going on.
So when women come to you, they've generally already been diagnosed. What are the first things that you do when you first meet a patient?
Well, I listen to their story, because I learn a lot from hearing what's happened to somebody, and I think just want to really understand what that individual has gone through, what different types of workup, and really understand the emotional part of the diagnosis. I certainly listen to the symptoms that woman is having. I personally look at all of their CT scans, laboratories, and put together the story around, how are things accelerating, really trying to triage, because to me, anyone who walks in the door with a diagnosis of advanced ovarian cancer is a medical emergency, because symptoms can change so quickly. So you know, at Dana Farber, we have a team of medical oncologists, with gynecologic oncology surgeons, and we see the patient together to come up with a treatment plan around, should that individual go to surgery first, or does it make more sense medically for us to make a diagnosis through a tissue biopsy, start chemotherapy, and then that lady have surgery after a few cycles of chemotherapy. So it's really, it's kind of all hands on deck when someone walks to the door.
And Ms. Poland was telling us that she went, did have the chemotherapy first and then some reduction surgery after that. The tell us about the research that you're involved in and some of the possibilities that you see for the future.
Yeah. So our research really spans from early detection, which I am not personally involved, but we have teams of researchers at Dana-Farber and the Brigham and Women's Hospital who study early detection, sort of new ways of early detection. We think about the genetics of the cancer, and that really sometimes can help with an ovarian cancer to determine treatment options. And then certainly treatment for women who, you know, have newly diagnosed ovarian cancer, but then also cancer that can recur. We have a large, as you mentioned before, National Cancer Institute grant on called a SPORE grant, the Specialized Program of Research Excellence in Ovarian Cancer. And those projects within that several million dollar grant covers treatment, new therapies. We have a vaccination study, which of course now has like a different connotation because of COVID. But it's something called the neoantigen vaccine, where we try to find new proteins within the cancer cell and try to vaccinate somebody to try to stimulate their immune system against those proteins that are not present in the natural cells. We're studying more rare cancers, those that individuals who have low-grade serous cancers or those who have a RAS mutation. And then different combinations of medications. And we're really trying hard to incorporate, because this grant goes on for many years, an early detection project as well. And then we also have research on how to improve somebody's quality of life. So one of my colleagues, Dr. Alexi Wright, has several trials open right now that are focused on trying to make someone's life better. And I heard Debbie mention that fatigue was one of her most significant complaints, and that's exactly what in one of Dr. Wright's trials that she's trying to combat is fatigue when women take a certain type of a drug called a PARP, P-A-R-P inhibitor. So our research really spans lots of different aspects of ovarian cancer, and you know, it's really incredibly gratifying coming to work every day and knowing that all of my colleagues are all, you know, we're all marching in the same direction. And that direction is to eradicate this cancer and try to make treatments better and come up with new and more effective therapies.
It's interesting that certainly in cervical cancer, there's been such heartening improvement in terms of prevention and perhaps treatment. Endometrial cancer, you mentioned that it's concerning that we seem to be going perhaps backwards just a little bit. Some of that may be due multifactorial. But in ovarian cancer, what would you say? Are we making progress?
So I think it's a great question. And in certain aspects, because ovarian cancer is a complicated cancer. And first of all, you know, you start off with different types of ovarian cancer. So the most common type is a cancer called a high-grade serous, S-E-R-O-U-S, cancer. And 80% of our patients have this type of histology or pathology. And this particular type of cancer is really unique because of the cancer cells' underlying problems with DNA repair. And that makes medications like platinum, carboplatinum, cisplatinum work very well. And these drugs called PARP, P-A-R-P, poly-ADP ribose polymerase inhibitors. So for the high-grade serous cancers, for somebody who has an underlying BRCA1 or 2 mutation, that particular subset of cancers are very sensitive to these medications.
You just mentioned, can I just jump in there? Those are two, in fact, many people in the general public may be aware that those are two genes or gene mutations that convey some increased risk for both breast and ovarian cancer. If a woman finds that she has that mutation, some women undergo prophylactic oophorectomy, which means removal of the ovaries. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I think it's important to really underscore that when somebody undergoes prophylactic surgery, that prophylactic surgery, if they have an underlying BRCA1 or 2 mutation or other mutations as well, that both the fallopian tubes and the ovaries come out, because we have learned a number of years ago, some of our pathologists in the Brigham have shown that the fallopian tube, so the end, we call it the distal tip, T-I-P, tip, so the end part of the fallopian tube can be where some ovarian cancers actually start. So it's important that, and this is pretty standard of care now, that around the world, somebody goes for prophylactic surgery, that both ovaries and fallopian tubes are taken out. So yes, that absolutely. I mean, for somebody who's 25, probably not. That wouldn't make much sense, because then, they want to have kids. But somebody who's 45, 50, 40, again, it's a very personal decision. But it's certainly the way of, 99% of the time eradicating that risk of ovarian cancer. It's not 100%, but it's as best as we can get it.
We talked about in endometrial cancer that there may be some modifiable risk factors such as weight. Are there any modifiable risk factors in ovarian cancer? Anything a woman can do other than even regular screening may or may not affect it, but anything people can do to reduce their risk?
Yeah, the only thing to do would be to understand your family history. So if you're part of there are at least 11 different genes involved in the inherited risk of ovarian cancer. The two major ones are BRCA1 and BRCA2. But understand your family history. And, now the costs of undergoing genetic screening are really low. It's, it used to be thousands of dollars. Now it's about $200. So it's really something that if you're worried, you can get done and understand the genetics, your inherited genetics. But no, other than that, there's the CA125 has been looked at up and down in terms of the ability to use as a screening marker. But it has not really been successful at all.
We're going to run out of time in just a minute. I think what you highlighted a few minutes ago is that you have a fantastic team working from every angle, research, clinical, social support at the Dana-Farber. Certainly people, if they're not getting what they feel is adequate care in other places, I'm certain can contact Dana-Farber or one of the other centers. And that's not a bad thing to do. On the other hand, here at University of Vermont, Ms. Paulin has had a wonderful experience as well. Ms. Paulin, I want to turn to you for the last minute. Any further thoughts or things that you'd like to say to women out there?
Definitely listen to yourself. Listen to the inside of your body and to act on it. And you may not be the doctor. When you go into an office, but more importantly, you are the patient. And the more you have to say, the better they can make determinations of what to do and how to help. So again, just self-advocacy is just so, so, so important.
Well, I want to thank you for being here. I think it takes a village, as you said, and a support network. Dr. Matalonis, thank you as well. We'll have to have you back on at a future time. There's so much more to talk about. I want to thank all of our listeners. Next week, our guest is going to be from the Massachusetts General Hospital, a neurologist, to talk about headaches. If you've had headaches, you'll want to listen to this show. Please join us then. And until then, be kind to yourselves. Be kind to others.